If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Pella Nuroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk, TNT.
So welcome to this Friday afternoon show on the Pella Nuroth-Taylor show on TNT News Talk. Well, the big news, or non-news, thankfully, is the Israeli counterstrike on Iran, which took place this morning. We were expecting it to come after Passover, which would be another 10 days Cuba-style wait, or 12 days. But it happened last night, and it was a nothing burger, as they say. Israel was under huge international pressure not to escalate. So in the news analysis this morning, it was talked of a de-escalatory escalation. Sure, they attacked near Isfahan, which is close to Iran's nuclear facilities, but the facilities themselves were not struck, and it seemed to be very minor, maybe just drones. And it was not an Israeli-based attack, but maybe just a local infiltration. We'll see them. Maybe Basil has more concrete details. But Iran pointedly say that there's no counter-escalation, as they promised violently in tweets and words last week, where they say that they have plenty of missiles where the ones were coming from their attack last, I think Saturday it was. So maybe the circle of escalation is quiet for now. Blinken, the American Secretary of State, they call it, doesn't want to talk about it. But I think it was probably another sort of performance coordinated with the Chinese and probably the Russians, as exposed by Seymour Hersh, who's this top journalist, Pulitzer Prize winning, can't get published in the New York Times, but writes on Substack, which is an independent platform. There's many, many contacts in the CIA, in the State Department, the Deep State, Pentagon. And he says that the Pentagon rang up the Russians last week and they agreed to handle the issue, the Russians putting pressure on the Iranians. We know that the Russian head of the National Security Council, I think it is, or whatever, Nikolai Petrushev, who's the hardest of the hardliners, rang the Iranians and then he rang the Israelis. And of course, it's a huge nuclear power, as is America. So they stitched it up. Blinken put pressure on the Pentagon put pressure on the Israelis. Blinken may not have done, but it seems unclear. It seems that the State Department is still more hawkish than the Pentagon, funnily enough. The Pentagon being military types, who know exactly what the score is in terms of military attack and what the dangers are. And he got the okay from Biden, Pentagon chiefs. And that's so the State Department was bypassed somewhat. Anyway, for the moment, all's good. And it shows that when the great powers work together, things can happen and be done. And even feisty chutzpah Israel can't go against them too much. So we're very grateful for that. And I plan this weekend to look up the Yom Kippur War, which took place in 1973, which was also one of those nuclear danger moments, and which was also characterized by behind-the-scenes back-channel cooperation between Nixon, who's then president, and the Russians, the Soviets led by Brezhnev. And they de-escalated it. And one of the reasons I talked about this yesterday with my final guests, the neocons who thought that Russia was the devil, they didn't like this kind of back channel working out at all, and nor the collaborationist detente that Nixon, Kissinger for all his faults, had worked out with the Soviets and tried to destroy that. And they succeeded over the next few years and bringing us back to a state of Cold War by 1978 or 79. Anyway, I plan to look up that. The Israeli security minister's single-word tweet in Hebrew, feeble, said it all. So he's been outmaneuvered. Let's just pray that freelance operators or whatever, some factions in either Iranian government or the Israelis, will not see that this is insufficiently aggressive to the other side and start firing missiles. Of course, there will still be this shadow war back between Iran and Iraq, probably in Lebanon, if nothing else. And we've got this huge problem of Gaza. But at least the Hormuz Straits, through which much of the West oil flows, is safe. So we won't see sort of 500% inflation coming up. Anyway, Gaza's still a disaster of huge proportions. But we'll talk about these issues and whether there's even some Ukrainian peace in sight now that the Russians are making huge headway. We're talking to Johnny Miller, who's a British journalist based in Moscow, Furiela Isabel, an American journalist who's traveling quite a lot, and I hope she'll come on time, geopolitical analyst who also works in Moscow, but she's traveled widely, very experienced. But we're not just going to talk about that. We're going to talk to Eric Anderson, a Swedish engineer for Boeing, formerly, and who's looked at a court case in London that could blow things open on the whole Nord Stream case. I think there's going to be a lot of realization, a lot of reckoning with the West's deep states and their the whole Russian thing, fiasco, everyone, what everyone has done when this war finally ends. And the Nord Stream is going to be part of it. And he's going to tell us what he's found, which is not, which is, should have people in Whitehall worried, in my view. But our first guest is not so much about these current events, but more historical, but it's nevertheless interesting because it's about the persecution of Christians in the Soviet Union. American filmmaker and writer Julia Behling wrote about it. She did a thesis on it when she lived in Russia in the early 2000s. She's now written a book and made a documentary, which is coming up soon. She'll tell us about that, but she will also draw not so subtle parallels between the persecution of Christians in the Soviet Union and the apparent persecution that takes place in America today. So we will talk about that as our first break guest after the break. Her name is Julia Behling. But first, we've got Basil Valentine, our political editor, who's got the latest news from the hotspots of the world. After a very quick break, this is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon in spring. Welcome to the show, Basil Valentine, political editor. What's happening?
Good afternoon, Pelle, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world. Well, the foreign ministers from the G7 countries have been meeting in Capri this week. I imagine they've been having a jolly nice time in spring on that beautiful Italian isle. But the headline in the Daily Mail gives away just how round-headed, in fact, I would go so far as to say pig-headed and short-sighted they are. G7 comes for Putin, Ayatollah and Xi. Ukraine to receive frozen Russian assets to fund game-changing war chest. Iran is hit with more sanctions over Israel attack, and China is warned to stop arming Vladimir's forces. It's all very cartoonish, goodies and baddies stuff, but very disappointing to see Putin, Ayatollah Khamenei, and Xi Jinping lumped together in the same way that Speaker Mike Johnson did day before yesterday, talking again some nonsense about the axis of evil. Iran's retaliation for the strike on its consulate in Damascus was described as unprecedented, and they pledged their support for Israel's security, condemning it in the strongest possible terms. It's just the usual cliches and idiotic posturing and warmongering, Pelle.
Yeah. Is that money going to come, that's going to be spent reconstructing Ukraine, is it coming from the interest of the frozen Russian assets or the principal of the main money? Because if they did that, they would really, they would completely destroy the West's reputation for being a safe harbor for the global South's money. And I'm going to come to that
Well, it was the Italian foreign minister, Antonio Tajani, who said Western governments are reviewing the possibility of using Russian assets frozen in Europe to replenish Ukraine's war chest as Putin's forces continue to make gains in the Donbass, they've admitted. Yeah. The West has about £260 billion of assets locked down, with European countries now examining whether they can legally create a game-changing slush fund to fund Kyiv's war effort.
Well, the thing you've got to, I don't know if it's a game changer in terms of what they've agreed now, but I followed the funding, the use of the Russian frozen money issue, and I've seen a lot of questioning and doubt, at least. Although Mike Johnson might have changed the game now that Americans, Europe feels more confident now that America's kind of put its support behind Ukraine and what's happened this week with Mike Johnson apparently retreating from his MAGA stance. I wonder, because you've got to detach the Daily Mail's interpretation of it. you know, from the big talk from the G7 ministers, which is maybe to assuage Israel and maybe to make these non-entities seem important, and then it comes burrow down into what's actually going to happen. So we'll see. But it's, of course, it's boring, all this warmongering, you know, dictator of the world type talk, you know, and all this. As soon as I hear the word Putin, I always know that that article is going to say the same old sort of. I mean, the very word, because it's basically it's the Russian government. I mean, Putin's probably one of the most moderate persons in that Russian government, and the Russian people, they all seem to think, agree on this. But by personalizing it, of course, the Daily Mail and the British warmongers are sort of saying, well, Putin's basically isolated and he's a kind of evil Sauron type leader, Sauron, whatever. And, you know, if he can only be removed, the Russians can be liberated and join the happy consumerist democratic world of the West. But of course, he represents his people, I think. He's the will of his people. And you can't just, I don't know. I hate this language. It's so infantile.
I agree. And besides, Russia joined the consumerist West in 1991, didn't it? And
exactly.
Was never officially left.
I know. Of course. And it's all nonsense, because we were supposed to be on war on communism. And then when the Russians said, well, okay, we left communism now, and now it's still a war on Russia. So, I mean, when the Russians say, well, you just hate us for what we are, we're too big for you, I think the Russians have a point, you know?
Yes, I'm all sorts of dark reasons as to where this original enmity comes from them, some sort of, you know, historic tribal disagreements, a simple power play, because they represent a significant alternative global power base from the one dominated by the United States and Europe, you know? But they were willing to join that power base. I mean, I remember, didn't Putin attend G7 ministers meetings 20 plus years ago?
It was it was known as the G8 until 2014. I mean, Russia was a paid up full member.
There you go.
And you know, they wanted to join NATO, and Clinton said, yeah, of course you can join NATO. And then he consulted his deep state, his minister, you know, the CIA, and they said no. Basically, because Russia... I mean, I think the whole thing, if there is a back channel talk with Russia pulling in, reining in Iran, or perhaps warning everyone that we've got nukes too, I think it actually paves the way, shows that thank God that the great nuclear powers can collaborate. And I think the smaller powers hate that. The Brits hate it because it removes some of their leverage over the United States. But I think that the Russians, I'm going to ask, I've got some Russian commentators on today, whether the Russians just want to join the club. But by the very nature of joining this club, the directorate of Western powers, the great powers, they will, of course, squeeze out almost everyone else except the Americans. And I think a lot of countries don't want that. And many in the deep state in America don't want to have on board a country, let's say, which is half as powerful as they are, with the economy, or a third, which will be able to call the shots in a way that smaller European pygmies or middle powers like Germany and France and Britain can't do. And that's the problem as I see it. You know, the Russians can play a responsible role. They're just being kept out. But if they'd been invited in, they'd take a responsible part. And I think that's where we should be. Ditto China.
You're absolutely right. It would represent a dilution of American power, particularly as and when China, the second biggest economy in the world, joins the club. Speaking of which, Tony Blinken, at the meeting, urged his European counterparts to increase the pressure on Beijing. I'm not quite sure how they do that, given that the Chinese make just about everything in European shops, who he accused of fueling the Ukraine war by aiding Russia. We express our strong concern about transfers to Russia from businesses in the People's Republic of China of dual-use materials and weapons components that Russia is using to advance its military production. Meanwhile, of course, they talked of ramping up sanctions on Iran, even though no one was killed in the fully choreographed Iranian retaliation for Israel's bombing of its consulate. And I can't finish this segment without referencing what Ben-Gvir, the Israeli security minister, one of the avowed fascists and racists in Netanyahu's coalition, although one could legitimately argue they all are, he did a one-word tweet, feeble, that's the English translation of the Hebrew, when referring to Israel's strike first thing this morning on Iran, particularly Isfahan. It's being seen as a de-escalatory. Observers are interpreting it as a de-escalatory strike that should mean a line is drawn in the sand after this particular exchange of unpleasantries between Israel and Iran, but all at the expense of the Palestinian people, because Netanyahu went to the White House and said, basically, we either launch World War III by attacking Iran full scale, or you let us destroy what's left of Gaza and demolish Rafah in its entirety. And unsurprisingly, the White House said, do what you want in Gaza. We don't care about those Palestinians. Yeah. Just don't start World War III. That was the devil, the devil's bargain written in blood, Pele.
Devil's bargain indeed. And of course, you know, there'll be a lot of us, I mean, rightly saying, it's one thing, we're protecting ourselves, our lives. We don't want to end up in a third world war in Europe and so on. And we're ready to sacrifice the Palestinians to do so because of the huge double standards here from the West involved, you know, because we put the pressure on the Israelis in a way we simply didn't do over Gaza. But maybe we can talk about that more because, of course, it is a big moral issue. But I'm very glad just for the moment that we haven't seen a World War III break out over something. But anyway, Basil, we'll have you more on the day's news in an hour's time. And we're going to go into our first guest. Thanks a lot, Basil. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. Back with after a break.
TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats.
It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom. And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
The conversation continues.
I don't believe it, and I think that's a terrible position that I am in, that I don't trust my government.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. Well, we've talked about plenty about persecutions of Jews and Muslims, but right now we're going to talk a little bit about persecution of Christians in the Soviet Union and today's America. Starting off with the Soviet Union, we've got Julie Bayling with us, who has written a book and made a documentary called Beneath Sheep's Clothing, The Communist Takeover of Culture in the USSR, Parallels in Today's China. She was went to, she's an American, and she attended graduate school at Florida State University and pursued a dual master's degree in Russian languages and literature and Russian and East European studies at Florida State University. She taught beginning and intermediate Russian for three of those years and wrote her master's thesis on the underground Christian movements in the Soviet Union, their survival tactics, and the tactics of the Soviet state to stamp them out. And the obvious parallel, or you can draw Christian movements in the Soviet Union, their survival tactics, and the tactics of the Soviet state to stamp them out. And the obvious parallel, or you can draw parallel, which is can be quite rewarding. I mean, it's not exact parallel with what's going on in the United States today. I've heard some horror stories of the way the Christian community in America has been treated. But we're going to go into the Soviet Union, which of course ended in 1991 with the end of communism. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us about the way that I was struck. I'll just start off with a little anecdote, which I heard you talking about elsewhere, that Christians in the Soviet Union had to pretend to have birthday parties out in the open, out in the forest or something, so they could teach their kids Christianity. So there were basically an awful lot of people going on birthday parties all the time out in the woods in the Soviet Union. That's quite funny, isn't it?
Yeah, this was the dissident Christians, the unregistered Christians. They were actually considered to be cultists in the Soviet Union. They had a social status lower than rapists and murderers. And this is not the mainstream Christians, right? That so the churches that the government infiltrated and approved of. But yeah, they would have to come up with different excuses to be able to meet together. It was illegal for them to teach their children religion, so they had to have excuses.
Hmm. Well, so which religions or which movements inside Christianity were counted as cults in the Soviet Union?
Yeah, the unregistered Baptists, Pentecostals, Seventh-day Adventists, and Adventists, and also Jehovah's Witnesses,
right,
were the special targets as and considered cults.
Mm. Is there any reason, or what reasoning was used, or was no reasoning used to justify the fact that these were suppressed?
Well, I mean, historically, under the czars, these foreign churches were, some of them didn't exist in Russia during the czars, but they were also heavily persecuted during that time. The Russian Orthodox Church, everyone was supposed to be Orthodox. It was tolerated for people a little bit who were not ethnic Russians to be part of these foreign churches or cults. But under the Soviet state, as time went on, these were the groups that showed the most backbone against the Soviet government. They insisted on bringing their children to church. They insisted on teaching their children to pray. Some of them engaged in human rights campaigns to lobby for freedom of religion. So they were a thorn in the side of the Soviet state, and they had to be suppressed at all cost.
Well, what about mainstream Christians? Can you tell us how that was organized? Because let's remind ourselves, what is this thing that communism had against religion? Assume you're talking to people who don't know anything about communism, because, I mean, we've got a whole generation that was born after the Cold War. I mean, you've got to be almost middle-aged to remember anything about it. So, you know, what is communism, you know?
Communism itself acts as a religion, but even though it claimed in the Soviet state, they claimed they were atheist, but the state was the god, and it was a very jealous god. It couldn't have any other gods before the state, and the leader of the state needed to be preeminent in the minds of the people. And Christianity in particular was, communism is essentially an inversion of Christianity. But Christianity is the leading oppositional ideology to communism. And so devout Christians, devout Jews are not loved under Soviet, you know, under communist regimes either, or is anyone really. But especially Christians, devout Christians that have to be suppressed, because that provides people, the people of the state, with a different way of looking at the world. I mean, Christians believe in a God that will take you to a paradise in the hereafter. The communists are looking to create the paradise on earth with themselves at the top and at the helm. Mm. They don't want people having a faith in any god.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I didn't I went to the Soviet Union in 1991 when literally I was there for the coup in Moscow when communism ended as a student journalist.
Wow.
And then I did. So I know people totally fed up with communism and very pro-Western. But I remember going to some outposts of communism in let's say Ukraine and Moldova and places like that. And it really was like going into a religious shrine. You'd have this worshipful statue of Marx in a velvet orange red sort of background. And I can see that. I mean, absolutely, I can see the Christianity and religion. And when here in Sweden, I've studied how the Christian religion displaced the old pagan religions. And often they built churches on the sites of the old pagan mounds, you know, the Norse gods like Odin and Thor. So religions always try to kind of displace old ones by taking on some board some of their rivals' exterior attributes, if you like.
Right.
But who was the jealous god of communism then? Because I think we're all religious in a way. We just have different religions. Who was the jealous god of the Marxists?
Well, the government, the people at the top, the people, because communism is a maximum consolidation of power into the hands of a few people. And so those few people at the helm of the communist state, of the Soviet state, are the jealous gods. I mean, Stalin was so jealous to the point where he massacred, you know, upwards of a million communists, like devout believing communists. Yeah. In the attempt to try to kill off any potential threat to his power. So they don't want people to be able to have any power. They want the power for themselves.
We've got to have a news break, and we might as well take it now when you just paused. We could last a minute or so. We've got Julie Bayling with us talking about communism and religion and Soviet Union and America. We'll be back after a minute's news after the break. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Show them how it's done.
Let's go.
I got news for you.
News.
Matt Boyland here with your TNT headlines. Israel has launched a limited strike against Iran in response to its retaliatory airstrikes over the weekend. The Bank of America is warning a direct war between Israel and Iran could send oil prices soaring to $130 a barrel. Over 100 university students protesting Israel's war in Gaza have been arrested in dramatic scenes at a campus in New York. And South America's Argentina has applied to become a new global partner of NATO.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Julie Bayling with us, who has written a book and a documentary about Christianity and the suppression of it in the old Soviet Union, and you can draw parallels with what's going on today in the United States. It's called Beneath Sheep's Clothing, and you can find it. You just Google the word I did this morning, and it comes up immediately. Okay, Julie, so yeah, we're talking about gods and how the communists wanted gods, and they were jealous gods that oppressed the Christians. So Christians were sort of a threat to the state because they had a different belief system. But only that the Jehovah's Witnesses and sort of far out, as it were really persecuted. But how did the state, Soviet state, deal with mainstream Christians? Did they infiltrate it, or what did they do?
Well, I mean, during the Bolshevik Revolution, they massacred and executed Orthodox clergy. They decapitated the Orthodox Church, brought it to its knees. They went against everyone, but they found that just wholesale persecution of Christians led to a lot of underground religious activity that they had no control over. After World War II, the Soviets retooled their tactics and decided that they would infiltrate the churches. They did so with KGB agents. They sent them into the clergy. They would rise up within the churches. The Russian Orthodox Church, the Registered Baptist Church, for example, are two prime examples. They would control the churches from within. They would make sure that the sermons were incongruent with the Soviet platform. They made sure that they made the members of those churches follow the rules, which was you can't bring your kids to church, don't teach your kids at home. And it led to a die-off of the churches more so than had previously happened. So the Soviets kept their strong tactics of arrest, and they would take kids away from people to those dissident Christians who did not register with the government, putting them in the gulag all the way up into the 80s. You have a Baptist choir master of an unregistered Baptist church going to the gulag for 5 years, for example.
Incredible.
Over the top. Yeah.
I remember I was they rebuilt after the end of communism. In some ways, Russia seems to become an ostentatiously Orthodox country. They've rebuilt a lot of churches. I know they rebuilt a few around Red Square, and on the site of what used to be a swimming pool. I think they blew up something in the 1930s and they rebuilt it or something.
Yeah, so, but
there's a lot of pictures between Putin and Orthodox and so on. So how would you describe the situation after communism?
Well, it's kind of reverted to what it was under the czars. So the logo that of the czars, the autocracy was one head, it's a two-headed eagle. One head was the czar, the other head was the patriarch of the Orthodox Church. The insignia of Russia. And so that's kind of what they've gone back to. It's Russian nationalism is very closely tied with Russian Orthodoxy, and they have brought those two things back together in Russia, for sure. Mm.
Do you think it's had a positive development for Russia? I mean, if we, I'm agnostic, but I think that moderate Christianity is a good thing. It's socially stabilizing and people seem much happier. I live in a very churchy town in Sweden, and I can see the influence. So do you reckon it's been good for Russia? Because, you know, so many people are critical of Russia, but it seems to be a better place than it was during the Soviet Union.
Yes, it's a better place. My friends that I met in Russia when I was a missionary there in the late 90s have a much higher standard of living. I mean, the fact that there's not really religious freedom in Russia right now, if, you know, someone is part of a foreign Christian church, they don't have the same level of freedom as Russian Orthodox, but there's not like heavy oppression like there was under the Soviet Union. And I do think that the Russian people, they're one thing that shocked me when I was a missionary just a few years after the collapse of the Soviet Union within Russia is that I met only one atheist, and I talked to 1,000+ people asking if they believed in God. One person said no in a year and a half of me asking people every day if they believed in God.
That's so incredible. And what year was this?
97 and 98.
Right.
Yeah.
So the official atheism didn't seem to work that well. If most people, I mean, the atheism level in Europe is like 30% or 40%. And here you are saying nearly everyone was religious.
Russia never had a reformation. So religion is very close to the heart of Russian people. It is.
Very interesting. I think that deserves emphasizing. It really does. Because you can't understand, we talk about Russia almost purely in geopolitical terms or materialistic terms. Well, let's quickly, I'm afraid we've only got 3 minutes left. It's one of those interviews that we have to cover topics quite quickly. But one of the most shocking things sitting here in Europe and talking to Americans from all backgrounds is how America, which is generally regarded as more religious and was founded on religious freedom, you know, you left Europe so because we were oppressive. But there's been a lot of repression of Christians recently, and to some extent mirrors your experiences. Can you tell us to what extent Christians are oppressed in the United States? We've got about 3 minutes to do this.
It's not that Christians are being oppressed on a wholesale level, but what it is the same that I noticed, the same tactics that the Soviets used to try to dismantle Christianity that I researched for my thesis, they're all in place in America and in the West in general, too. You have the infiltration of the churches with communism. You have anti-Christian propaganda in the media, where Christians are portrayed almost purely in a negative light. That's been going on for decades in America. You have the schools that have been overtaken with deleting Judeo-Christian ethics as the foundational ideology of the children and inserting woke Marxism, diversity, equity, and inclusion as the new foundational ideology of the children. And priming children to accept communism in America. And it's very shocking to me. And it's shocking to a lot of Americans. A lot of people are waking up to that. And we also do have a severe repression of fringe groups in America that are considered cults, where they've received militarized raids from the government, the American government.
I think we might have a few extra minutes, actually. Tell us a little bit more about these militarized raids, because these are concrete things that can really tell a story just by giving an example, and people would be astonished if they hear it. Who's been raided and how did they?
Well, there's the two biggest examples are the Branch Davidians that happened in 1993. I was finishing up high school when that happened. And that I have a whole chapter in my book that goes into detail with what happened there. Not saying that I personally agree with the views of the Branch Davidians myself, But the evidence shows that they were probably killed by the government, at least some of them. And then it was they were the ones blamed for those deaths. It was a very, very sad tale. And then in 2008, the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Mormons in Texas, also received a raid. They had their children taken from them with no due process. And eventually the kids had to be given back, but the damage was done. This was actually part of a playbook that was developed by a group called the Cult Awareness Network in the early 80s to try to destroy minority Christian groups. And their playbook very starkly represents that of the Soviet playbook to destroy Christianity.
But who in America willed this? I mean, was it within 2008? That was Bush. I mean, Bush was obviously he was a Christian and a Republican. So what are the forces here? You know,
that was the Texas authorities that enacted that raid. They were the federal government was not involved, to my knowledge, with the 2008 raid. However, in 1993, the federal government was very, very much involved with the raid upon the Branch Davidians. And a lot of lies were told about that. And a lot of those lies have been exposed in recent years, but it's a very sad chapter in America's history with what happened there.
We'll keep on for a bit. We've got someone in Moscow's some problem with the phone, I think. But gender Marxism or whatever you want to call it, also like communism, which was much more focused on economics. So the difference between the communism, that's why I was hesitant to use the word communism to talk about both things, right? Because one was about economic equality I talked to people in Eastern Europe who said that, you know, if your father had been an officer or an academic, you couldn't go to university. And now you have these enormous social equity and inclusion rules that mean that if you're white, so it's gone from a class war to a race war against whites, you know, and people with two parent families and so on. Would you say that some of this, just as communism had religious features with the strong gods and the rituals and all those things, does gender Marxism or transgender craze, whatever you want to call it, does that also have some religious features?
I would say it has more than religious features. It has features of a cult, and the children in the schools, although a lot of these kids that come out as transgender are children who are very vulnerable. They're children who are on the autism spectrum. They're children who have been sexually abused, children who are socially awkward. And essentially what's being used in the schools is Maoist brainwashing tactics with the social and emotional learning curricula that we have in upwards of 95% of America's schools now. And what this does is it makes the kids who are white, who middle class, heteronormative, cisnormative, they're the oppressors. And that means they're bad. In order for kids not to be in the bad category, they have to become a victim. They have to join a victim class. And the easiest way for white kids to stop being oppressors is to pick one of the many gender and sexual identities that they are exposing the kids to. And then
That's very interesting. I'd never heard that. And it makes perfect sense because it's probably so everyone in school, you remember school years, you become a survivor in a sense, and you adapt not to be picked on or bullied. And this makes you really explained something in a simple explanation there. So the white kids, something like, I haven't seen the statistics for the US, but I've seen statistics for the UK, and it's like 40% of the population regard themselves as LGBTQ or whatever of young population.
Right.
And I went to a London prep school, which normally provides elite civil servants and probably still does. And they're taught to adopt an identity. Can you believe it? You know, so in my time, you taught to speak posh Oxford English, and now they have to have an LGBTQ identity to be able to get into the civil service and not be harassed by, you know, the blacks and the Chinese or whatever working for it. So in a way, what you're saying is that you're really drawing up the battle lines here, because you're saying, well, it's not Christianity, it's the cult, it's the transgender stuff, that's the cult. And I would agree. I mean, I'm Can you just give some characteristics of what you regard a cult to be? Because I think this is exactly where we should be having this conversation. We can't lie down and take it. What defines a cult?
Well, if people are not allowed to disagree, or if they speak up and disagree, they're canceled, or they're automatically bad. If you're automatically evil because you disagree with someone, the people that are trying to push everyone to have the same view, that's a feature of a cult. There's actually a whole group of kids and now young adults who are detransitioning, who, you know, started on the pathway to transition to the other gender or whatever the gender affirming care, and then they detransition. They're rejected and discarded by this society, and no one wants to hear from them. No one on the left, that is. That's another feature of a cult, is that you're discarded if you disagree.
Julie Binning, I think we've got there's some instructions here from the studio I'm trying to determine, but we'll just take a break now, but I'll just give you a heads up. This is Julie Binning, who's done a documentary, Beneath Sheep's Clothing, and a book. And the documentary, is it out yet, or it's coming
out? May 23rd.
May 23rd, and on a particular platform, or just Google it?
People can go to beneathsheepsclothing.movie and purchase tickets there. It will stream there at beneathsheepsclothing.movie, and it will also stream on Rumble.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and we might talk to you again. We'll just see you back. Okay. But we're going to get into a break now. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT. Thanks for a very interesting talk on cult Christianity, the Soviet Union, and today's United States of America. Thanks a lot.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses. But there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision that this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
The mornings, that's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Coming to you live from Sweden, you're with Pelle Neroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've still got Julie Binning with us. She's gracing us with her presence for a couple more minutes, and that's very good because we have more things to talk about. And I was going to say, we're just talking in the break, because in Sweden, where Julie's ancestors come from, Christianity was severely oppressed. And when you were talking about people going and sitting in the woods, that's exactly what happened in Sweden as well. You had this very authoritarian state church, the Swedish church. But a lot of the, because I wrote some books about Sweden. I thought, well, I'm sitting here, I'll write some books about his Swedish history. And a lot of the source material in English, which you can find on Google Books for free, is missionaries going to Sweden in the 1830s, 1840s, Baptists and Methodists, talking about Sweden as this absolute tyranny, basically. And people going out into the forest, people being jailed and called lunatics and things like that if they were Baptists or Methodists. And people sitting, you know, furtively sitting by streams and pretending to read love poetry to each other, when in fact they were reading the Bible. It was almost impossible to get hold of the Bible. I mean, even the Bible was like a forbidden book. People reading the catechesis, whatever you call it in English, you know, Martin Luther's book, and then the hymn book, the Psalms. But the Bible was almost banned, and that was until 1860. And of course, one third of the Swedish population emigrated to America. And a quarter of the Norwegian population, and it was starvation partly, but or famines. But and one thing they needed to be able to immigrate, and some of my ancestors emigrated. I mean, obviously, I grew up in Europe and mostly in Britain. But on the sort of cousin's side, they went to live in America. But they you needed a signature from a priest if you're going to leave your parish. And there's one of the most famous Swedish novels has a guy who returns to Sweden and laughs and is free in his opinions. And the local priest says, aren't you a bit too, who are you sort of thing, you know, at a kind of get together back in his local village. And he says, I don't need to grovel to you because I can say what I want. I don't live here anymore. I live in America. So that was a kind of contrast between American freedom and Swedish authoritarianism. But that was a Swedish state church, and that was baptism versus and Methodism, which were regarded as crazy religions. But anyway, I forgot what I was going to say on the religious issue. Yeah, so very, very similar to this idea that the Russians had to pretend to spread. Funny that the Bible can be regarded as so subversive. And the baptism could be Baptists could be regarded as so subversive. You're going to say about your background was partly Swedish, right? And your ancestors were religious.
Yeah. I'm about 1/4 Swedish, and my Swedish ancestors came to America for religious freedom. Yeah. Mm.
And is that so? Tell us. Because writing a book like Beneath Sheep's Clothing about religious freedom means that, is this a subject that you studied for a long time, even before you went out to Russia?
I mean, no more than average. I really, what got me interested in studying all of this was when I was in Russia as a missionary. And again, I was surprised that out of everyone I spoke with, I met one person who said they were atheist. And then I did meet a few people who their families had been believers throughout the Soviet era. And I met some Seventh-day Adventists in Russia. And the level of faith of these people was unlike anything I'd ever seen in my life. It was absolutely astounding. And so I was really curious, how were they able to practice their faith during the 70 years of oppressive Soviet rule? And so when I was in grad school studying Soviet history, writing papers, I kind of delved into that a little bit. And so I did decide to write my thesis on it. I went back to Russia and did research, met people that were part of those groups. One of them, the underground Pentecostal church, was still operating underground as of 2002 when I was there, when I went back. And I really found that there were three major tactics that the Soviets used to try to destroy Christianity post-World War II. It was a more sophisticated set of tactics than their earlier tactics of slash and burn. Again, it was the propaganda campaigns, including getting into all the schools and having the kids indoctrinated within the schools against religion, and anti-Christian, pro-communist propaganda throughout the media as well. And then the continued heavy persecution of the fringe groups, only the fringe groups that no one liked, that everyone considered cults. So it was low cost. And third, the infiltration of the churches to control them from within. And so that's what I really delve into in both the book and the documentary. We also go into the one world religion that the UN and World Economic Forum are trying to set up globally. They can control the ideological framework of the entire planet.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that, because that's very interesting too. What are the distinguishing marks of that religion, would you say, and how can you tell that it's going on based on your knowledge?
Yeah, I interviewed for my film, I interviewed someone who worked with these people who were setting this up, people in the World Economic Forum, and he knows them. He interacted with them. They were actually trying to recruit him. So he had firsthand knowledge of that. But if you go to the UN website and look at their 17 sustainable development goals, and they're all things that sound nice, but there's a kind of a sinister background there to that. But if you see those things within the churches, if you see diversity, equity, and inclusion, and sustainable development, and global citizenship preached within a church, that's a red flag that your church has is taken on this one world religion they're going to try to make all of the major churches take this on. And the churches that won't go along with it are going to be persecuted, and they are being persecuted. That's why we see conservative churches in America now having, FBI people watching them and taking notes, people being arrested. You have people who peacefully protested abortion clinics in America getting the Gestapo at their doorstep, essentially, and been taken off to prison. And it's very disturbing, and we need to, I'm trying to wake up.
I mean, again, I'm in the smallest cathedral town in Sweden, in Western Sweden. It's called Skara. You can look it up. And it's got a kind of churchy feel. It's got a population of about 10,000, but compared to Sweden, it's very secular. But here, there's a feeling of the church. And there are three churches and people, it's got a calm, sort of relaxed atmosphere. And the church is 1,000 years old. It's the birthplace of Christianity in Sweden. So four times as old as the United States itself. But yeah, they are teaching what you're saying, this one world religion. And I have a family who kind of work in the church. And I'm not impressed because it is all this kind of climate change, you know, love all cultures equally. No mention once of Christianity. And when I talk about persecution of Christians in the Middle East, I mean, I don't bear any anger towards people of other cultures. I'm just pointing it out. Shouldn't you be defending that? No, I've barely seen a cross anywhere. And rather kind of insulting art, you know, like Ecce Homo, maybe you know about it, where they had really sort of modern art that puts Christ in an unflattering situation. And I think most people in Sweden, even the religious ones, especially the religious ones, are conservatives of the small c. You know, they go to church because they want comfort and tradition. It's what their parents did. And they're not on board with this at all. It's only the church officials, all the leftists who can't get jobs from after they left university, you know, like humanities graduates, like women in their 20s, really radical types, you know. It's always the same type, and they love refugees, you know, and they're completely unrealistic, and they go right into the church and become press officers or journalists or whatever, or young priests. And they are totally out of touch with what the average, it's a farming area as well. They don't want that stuff, you know. And so the Swedish church, which gets its money from taxes, is going to die out eventually because people are leaving it in droves. It's one of the most privileged churches in the world because it actually gets state money. You have to opt out of it if you don't want to pay your whatever 2% of your income in taxes to this. It's a very well-funded church. I'm just saying this because you have Swedish background, but it sounds very, yeah, very familiar. But do these churches, I mean, the people who, the background, who are the source of all this, are they aware that they're creating a religious movement? I mean, is it, how much consciousness is there, what's going on there? Or is this just your interpretation that it's a religious movement, this one world stuff?
The people at the top in the UN and the World Economic Forum know what they're doing. And yeah, they're seeking to subvert. They look, you can't get rid of religion. Humans are wired to have a belief in something bigger than themselves. You cannot do away with religion. So they've realized it has to be fully co-opted if they want to control humanity. Yes, people at the top understand that. There's many levels of other people who don't understand the different things. But yeah, but they're seeking to, and just as what the Soviets did, to de-emphasize the aspects of Christianity that are actually Christianity, which is that Jesus is the savior of the world who died for your sins, and you can become one with God by following Jesus and turning yourself over to him and connecting with God, and you can have that one-on-one connection with God. All of that's de-emphasized, and what is emphasized again is being nice and the diversity, equity, inclusion, sustainable development. And Christians are supposed to be nice. We are supposed to look out for all different types of people and look out for the oppressed. And so it's been actually easy for them to co-opt a lot of the Christian churches this way.
Well, and what can we do constructively to oppose this? Because as you said, we're all religious, and there's an enormous, I mean, we're religious creatures looking for a religion, and we want a good religion in a way. What can we do? We got 2 minutes left, and then we'll have to let you go because we've got news and other stuff coming on.
I mean, for Christians who are devout Christians, I think they need to understand what's going on. And I hope my film Beneath Sheep's Clothing, even for people, because look, the whole Western world is under attack here. And the Christian faith in the Western world in particular is under attack. And so to understand what's going on, understand these issues, watch Beneath Sheep's Clothing when it comes out, and then take this information to your clergy. And look, I don't want to tell people to leave a church that is teaching this stuff. I don't know what each individual is supposed to do. I think that we need to ask and tune in and ask God ourselves what we're supposed to do. I feel like I'm doing my part here with getting this information out. But someone else might have a different role. But we need to expose what's going on. And for people who are devout Christians, go back to those principles that are laid out in the Bible instead of all this newfangled stuff.
Okay, Julie, we've got a minute left. Do you have any other projects in mind after this, or are you just waiting to see how the success of this pans out?
Yeah, we have. We actually have a movement where we have some information that we're putting together for people who watch Beneath Sheep's Clothing, because it's going to be disturbing to a lot of people to see this information laid out. And we're going to provide solutions step by step. How can people, you know, and it's geared towards America, but it'll be applicable towards the West in general, the Western Europe in general, how to get the Marxist stuff out of the schools, how to get this stuff out of our churches. How can we go back to things that will help our nations to be able to survive and not be subverted by communism?
Okay, Julie Bailing, Beneath Sheep's Clothing, thank you very much for appearing on this Friday afternoon. And I wish you the best of luck. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show, and we will go into our next hour with more guests and more analysis and more news. Thank you very much. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT.